we'll be looking at two people, because the ideas of Marsilio Ficino were also taken up by a fellow called Castiglione. And Castiglione cast them into his work called The Courtier, and they followed Ficino's letters and writings across all of Europe and had deep influence in these islands also. And if you have any questions, I'm certain we have all the expertise amongst us to handle it. And I'd like to help beginning by a wonderful statement by an American historian. And he said that if you wanted to find God in the 10th century, you went to a monastery. And if you wanted to find God in the 13th century, you went to the divinity faculty of a university. And if you wanted to find God in the 15th century, you went to the court. I think imaginatively most of us can grasp the first two statements. But for some of us, the third statement might sound a little new. And the very fact that there was a whole new world where the exploration of the nature of the divine and the relationship of the human to the divine, where it was both cleric and lay, male and female, initiate and, quote, expert, is a world that we've somewhat lost contact with. There has been the intervening time of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and that, in a sense, has gone a little different in terms of its movement. But one of the interesting things about the fact of the Renaissance, the rebirth of the classical learning in Greece and Rome, especially beginning in Florence, is the fact that you and I obviously know Botticelli and Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, we could go on, but we forget that they were all based upon a philosophy, upon a spirituality, and they were all deeply informed by this. And it seems to me that what they discovered, rediscovered, is something that we can rediscover today. So it's wonderful we can have a conversazione. And that's what the Italians love. And one of the great persons, of course, of this whole period is going to be Erasmus. You remember Erasmus. Now the interesting thing is that when Erasmus made his translation of the New Testament in terms of John, you know that word logos, and we use the word word, Erasmus said, the conversation was made flesh and dwelt amongst us. And that dialogue that obviously reflects the nature of the divine is something that was rediscovered in the Renaissance, and we'll want to look at that today. And another thing I think that's important, there's a wonderful French contemporary scholar called Pierre Hadot. And Pierre Hadot has done a great deal of work on the Stoics, on Marcus Aurelius, on Greek philosophy in general. He's rescued Greek philosophy from our ideas. You know this idea of PhD, a doctor of philosophy? What is a philosopher? A philosopher who knows a great deal, who has a great deal of knowledge, who is an expert, who's very bright, probably large ego. But the point is that the true meaning of philosopher is not a person who has a great deal of knowledge, but a person who follows a way of life. And one of the things that Marsilio Ficino discovered, and then Castiglione carried on, is the fact that with their rediscovery of Platonic thought and the Neoplatonic tradition, that it's the way of initiating ourselves into living a certain way of life that becomes extraordinarily rich. When we talk about the Italian Renaissance, of course, we look at Petrarch and Boccaccio, because they heralded this rebirth of the Greek and the Roman classics. And there's a wonderful statement here that Boccaccio made, and I think he was restating Petrarch when he said that poets were theologians speaking truth veiled in mystery. We are all acquainted with the classical statement that God is all truth, all beauty, and all goodness. Now, if you could cast your mind over the last several hundred years, perhaps 2,000 years, think of the amount of time that we have spent on reflecting upon God as truth. Think of all the dogma, think of all the doctrines, think of all the theology, all very good. Goodness. Well, all we have to do is pick up the evening paper and talking about the Lambeth Conference, talking about morality, talking about ethics. But if you think about it, how much energy have we put in on reflecting on God as all beauty? And one of the difficulties, of course, that we have, it seems to me that, Ian Forster, I'm American, so I guess I can say it, and Julianne's Australian, but Ian Forster had a wonderful statement. He said, Englishmen have well-developed minds, overdeveloped bodies, and underdeveloped hearts. Come in, Viv. It seems to me that the question with so many of us, and this is why I think Marsilio Ficino can be of assistance to us, and then the man who followed after him, Baldassare Castiglione, is the fact that what we have probably done is to overdevelop certain sides of our understanding of humanity and the divine, certainly in terms of truth and in terms of goodness, but we've neglected and underdeveloped that whole side of God as beauty. And what I'd like to do with you today is merely to see how that idea came into Florence, how it was picked up by Marsilio Ficino, and then how Castiglione later on took this and put it in his particular writings, especially one book that was very special called The Courtier, a book that had phenomenal influence on the Renaissance. Now, the difficulty is that if we go over to King's College or University College and we want to talk about the Renaissance, we say, well, what was the major book? They'll say, The Prince by Machiavelli. Well, the interesting thing is that perhaps that says a lot about us, but I don't know how much it says about the Renaissance, because I suspect if we asked that question of most of the people or many of the people in the Renaissance, they certainly would have acknowledged Machiavelli, but I don't know if they would have seen that as the central book that they'd be so concerned with, but perhaps The Prince by Castiglione. And The Prince becomes an extraordinarily important book because one of the persons who's influenced by that is going to be a gentleman who eventually is going to be the schoolmaster of Elizabeth I. And Elizabeth I is going to be educated according to the principles in The Courtier. And Elizabeth I is going to be a woman aware of not only her own particular world, but of the world of the classics. And one of the things that we do when we talk about the classics, if we would go back to that wonderful Stoic philosopher, Seneca. Seneca said that we are of our own time, but in addition to that, we reach across time, and we take the best people that have been, or does this sound like Matthew Arnold? The best that has been thought and felt, and that can be our contemporary at the present time. So what I'd like to do, and this will be an introduction for some of you, but for others it'll be something that you're very well acquainted, is just to see how the ideas of the Neoplatonic philosophy came into Florence, influenced the people of Florence, passed into Italy in general, and then passed into Europe. Are there any questions so far? Am I speaking loud enough? I'm not going to ask you if I'm making any sense. But it also seems to me that when one is dealing with someone like Marsilio Ficino, and what I could strongly recommend is that if you'd like to follow this up, just go to your public library and get out his letters, and you can encounter him directly. And it seems to me that letters are one of the best ways of having a conversation with a person. When I said that word, conversation, the rediscovery of the classics was not a one-way situation. When Petrarch actually found letters by Cicero, Petrarch just didn't read letters by Cicero. He said, there's somebody I can talk to. So Petrarch wrote letters to Cicero. And one of the interesting things in the Renaissance, we're going to find references to Saint Socrates. And we're going to find that there's a jump over time. If I might take just a moment, during the first century of Christianity, during the first 1,000 years and the first several 100 years after that, men and women kind of believed that history was something linear that went along. The wonderful thing, starting with Boccaccio and with Petrarch and then coming to a great flowering with Ficino, was the fact that the imagination entered into the whole element. And the imagination meant that one could take a leap over the centuries in the middle to the classical world. And this is how the word Middle Ages was invented. And when that element came in of the ability to imaginatively leap over the medieval period, the men and women of the Renaissance found that there were people whom they could talk to and whom they could listen to. And one of the great statements in the ancient world that some ages are of bronze, some ages are of silver, and a few ages are of gold. Ficino is going to say that Florence in the 15th century is going to be an age of gold. And Ficino is also going to say that Plato has now flown from Athens to Florence. And we're going to see how that has all come about. Anybody puzzled? I mean, there's a lot to be puzzled about. But how did it all come? Well, I'd like to look at some pictures because one of the most important things is that spirituality, philosophy, aesthetics, right living, civic virtue are all intertwined. They're not separate things. And so it seems to me that what we'll try to do in a few moments is not just use words and ideas and concepts, but look at some of the art that was produced in Florence and in Urbino to express this particular vision. Well, as you can recall, Constantinople, which had been the capital of the Roman Empire in the east for over 1,000 years, was under threat from the Ottoman Turks. They realized this very clearly. When you say crusade, the difficulty is not only do Muslims have a particular difficulty, but the Orthodox Christians have a particular difficulty. Because the Fourth Crusade didn't go to Jerusalem to capture. The Fourth Crusade saw much richer pickings in Constantinople, and they pillaged the Christian capital of Constantinople instead of going to Jerusalem. Now, this is a very sad thing, but of course it makes those of us who travel to Venice at the present time rather happy to see some of that booty. So the word crusade is very difficult for the Orthodox Christians in Constantinople as well as for the Muslims. But the emperor of the East saw that if Constantinople was to be saved from invasion from the Ottoman Turks, they would need to have some sort of rapprochement with the West so that the Western powers would send military to help them in the East. But of course we had that split that goes back, the split between Constantinople and Rome that started out as a theological one but came really a great cultural one. However, the emperor at the time, I don't know if any of you saw Seeing Salvation at the Millennium. There were so many things there. Oh no, not Seeing Salvation, I apologize. The Three Faiths exhibit at the British Library?
Yes.
The Sacred. Well, there were so many things to see, but it seemed to me one of the most important things was a signature by the Emperor of Constantinople on an agreed statement about the union of East and West, Rome and Canterbury. and that was there as part of that particular exhibit. But we'll come to see how that happened. But the Emperor of Constantinople realized that without the military assistance of the Western Christians, there wouldn't be the survival of the Byzantine tradition. And so they said, could we get together? And it was agreed that there would be an ecumenical council, and they went to Ferrara. And from the east, the emperor came, the patriarch, the Archbishop of Constantinople, and all of their retinue and all of their theologians, they came to Ferrara. But the difficulty is that things like ecumenical councils cost money. When you read about Lambeth these days, and should the Americans come or not, we're in somewhat the same situation. One of the fascinating things was that they started to have their conversations, but they ran out of money. And the de Medicis in Florence said, to put it crudely, we'll bankroll it. And so what happened was that these great exotic leaders of the East, the Archbishop of Constantinople, the Emperor of the East, their whole retinue, all of the theologians, came down to Florence. The de Medicis presided, the Pope sent representation, and they started a conversazione. The Christian writers and theologians of the West, of course, spoke primarily in Latin, and they quoted their great philosopher, Thomas Aquinas, who, of course, came from Aristotle. But the Greeks answered using the philosophical principles of Plato. Now, one of the most marvelous things was that except for one dialogue, most of Plato had been lost to the West. And so everybody was saying, Plato who? And a whole new spirituality, a whole new theology from the Platonic dialogues, the Platonic writings, came to the ears of the Florentines. The wise de Medicis took the son of their physician, whose name was Marsilio Ficino, and they commissioned him to translate the works of Plato into the vernacular, some of the Italian, and certainly into the Latin. And what we have here is this explosion of the Neoplatonic tradition into the West that had been lost for most people. And the person who is going to bring that along is going to be Marsilio Ficino. The exciting thing, of course, about this is going to be that Plato is going to have that dialogic form, and Plato is also going to be very concerned with the nature of beauty. Do you mind if I jump ahead for a moment to Castiglione? Because in The Courtier, there's a wonderful, wonderful statement that talks about the nature of God and how God comes to the human person. I'm sorry I'm jumping ahead about 35 minutes, but I thought you might be asleep by the time we get there. But Castiglione really is really restating Marsilio Ficino. What Castiglione says is, if you ask a Christian, what is love, what is God, we would immediately answer, God is love. But the question isn't, God is love, but the question is, how do you define love? And what Castiglione does, certainly in the tradition of Ficino, is to say that God emanates, expresses out as beauty. When the human person encounters and is overwhelmed by that beauty, the response that we give back is love. That the nature of love is the human response to divine beauty. And this centrality of beauty as a philosophical, as a theological context, is going to enter into the Western imagination now through Marsilio Ficino translating not only Plato, but the Neoplatonic tradition that has been through the West, is going to bring to the fore that element of contacting the divine through beauty. And of course, beauty is going to be something that has to do with harmony and proportion. And in this whole theory, we go back to Pythagoras, who's going to be part of it in a moment. I'll just jump ahead because you might be asleep again. Is this wonderful thing that music, according to this tradition, and this great thinker Boethius had been one of the persons to bring it into Christianity, is that there are three types of music. The music that you and I hear with our ears is the least valuable type. The most valuable is the music of the spheres, whereby that music that we don't hear, that is the harmony of the universe, exists. The second is going to be human music, is going to be that proportion and balance and harmony that exists within us. And this is also going to be expressed mathematically in the harmony and the proportion that we hear in the sound when we listen to music. Now, if you think about that for a moment, the most marvelous thing is that one of the difficulties I notice that when dealing with most people nowadays, I find that we're comparing ourselves to machines. Bart, what was the input that you had to the meeting? Notice I'm almost comparing him to a computer. And what's your output? Whereas this tradition, and interestingly enough, George Herbert, from Salisbury fame, is actually going to be part of this tradition that's going to come out of Ficino into the English-speaking world, is going to compare us to musical instruments. And Herbert is going to say it's natural that we go out of tune. And what we do is we have to tune ourselves. And if you go back to the early Christian thinkers in the patristic period, people like Augustine, what we're going to find is that the person of Christ is that tuning fork to which we adjust our musical instrument. Now, it sounds terribly philosophical, but the interesting thing is, where did a lot of this occur? Well, the de' Medicis are taking Marsilio Ficino, they are giving him all that he needs to bring the Platonic tradition, the Neoplatonic tradition of the West, into the Western imagination. And we're going to find that the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church at the time is also going to adopt this thinking. And there's a tremendous person along this line called Cardinal Bessarion, who comes from the East. And they're hoping that Cardinal Bessarion, of course, is that there can be that rapprochement between the East and the West. And he's going to give his library, especially of Neoplatonic thought, to the city of Venice. Now, the problem is that in the city of Venice, they're just going to put it in crates for about 100 years. But then they're going to build this phenomenal, phenomenal library that you can see nowadays next to St. Mark's in the piazza there. But the most important thing is when you go into that library, you have a stairway, and the stairway with frescoes on both sides is a way of externalizing the idea of the ascent of the soul to the divine, the purification as one goes up, and how the aesthetic experience and proportion and harmony is a way of moving through the material to the spiritual. So the next time you're in Venice, if you want to know Neoplatonic philosophy and be able to look at it, you might want to try to look at the staircase there. Well, any questions? Are we going too fast for those of you that haven't heard anything? And have others gone to sleep who've already heard it before? I know for me, the great thing is that Marsilio Ficino is not only dealing in facts and in ideas, But he has rediscovered that idea of what it means to be a human being. And what the Renaissance obvious,